Friends, we are, I believe, going directly to Ray O'Hanlon. Again, well, first of all, let's connect with Ray. Hello there, Ray. How are you?
Good morning, Adrian.
How are you? Hold on a second now. I get this music off in the background. How are you doing, sir?
I'm grand. I'm knocking back my coffee here. So I'm
good
I'm
for you.
Up
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, after a big struggle, I got my first cup of tea handed to me. So we're doing all right in that department.
Yeah.
Ray, you know, we have been friends, I think it's fair to say, since I was a young fella, and that you covered. The biggest...
I must have... yes.
Yeah. No, you were going to respond, but I, you know... Mm.
Not for family listeners.
Oh, that's true. That's very true. Ray, the biggest news and the most positive news to start the new year comes as I had mentioned a couple of minutes ago, that the cobwebs are being removed from Stormont Castle and those who were lost have been found. Tell us the great news about from Northern Ireland on the re-entry of the Stormont participants who've been getting paid for the last 3 years. Ray.
Yes, it is absolutely good news. And it brings with it, I suppose, a rather extraordinary image. Two women now leading government in Northern Ireland. You and I both remember a time of black and white photographs of grim-faced Northern Ireland politicians, all men. And now we have Arlene Foster and Michelle O'Neill, hopefully smiling, leading the people of Northern Ireland into better days. So not only the news that power sharing is to be restored, the Assembly has already met. They will elect an executive, but now there are two women in charge. I mean, that's not, in a way, there are several sort of headlines and several ways the story stands out. But certainly the image, we've had the Chuckle Brothers. Are we going to have the Chuckle Sisters? Hopefully we will. But certainly the image to the world is a very positive one of two women leading a government together. So we will see how it all unfolds in the days ahead.
Ray O'Hanlon, I just want to... your reaction to what appears to be a celebration throughout the island of Ireland, and many would say without the Irish government, without the British government, without the proposal which was put to both Arlene Foster, First Minister, and Michelle, that this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, no, that's important to emphasize. And I suppose, in a way, it's a sort of a negative when you think of it, that here are politicians and political parties in Northern Ireland who you would think would be charged with reaching agreement among themselves, but they couldn't, and in the end they had to sort of depend on a deal brokered by the two governments in Dublin and London. But we've seen this before in the sense that the US intervention, the intervention of President Clinton and the United States in succeeding administrations, that in Northern Ireland, you actually do need this outside brokering, not just from time to time, but almost nonstop. That it makes it easier for parties in Northern Ireland living in a very polarized society who might have difficulties with their own voters. But they can turn to their voters now and say, look, we've accepted a deal that has been well worked out by governments that you also recognize. And in one particular respect, in the British government, you also vote for. So you have to back us on this. It should also be remembered that here we have, unlike other parliaments, the Dáil, the House of Commons, the National Assembly in France, the Congress here in the United States, even though they are back in Stormont in an assembly, in an executive, it is an unusual parliament. In the other ones I mentioned, politicians and parties might vehemently disagree, but at the end of the day, they stand up, they sing the same anthem, and they salute the same flag. This is not the case at Stormont. There are two national identities under that roof, as well as competing parties. So in fairness to those parties, we should recognize difficulties that they do face. So the intervention and brokering of a deal by the two governments was, I suppose, absolutely necessary. And they seem to have done, Simon Coveney, Julian Smith, seem to have done a very good job.
I suppose as we look back to, you know, the establishment of the Good Friday Agreement, where the U.S. Rightly took vows, you know, for getting the assembly started in the first place. This one was done with little, if not no, help from the United States. Where does that leave us?
Well, I'm sure there was. I'm sure there was encouragement. I think that's been the case. In recent years, it has been generally understood that the United States is still there, ready to help, but they have been indicating that they're sort of turning over that responsibility more to the parties in Northern Ireland. This was evident during the George W. Bush administration and the Obama administration as well, that they're a little bit more standing off and allowing the parties and the governments on the other side to actually move things forward, but Irish America, as you know, hasn't gone away. I've already seen this morning a statement from Congressman Richard Neal, Chairman of the Friends of Ireland, about this, supporting it and reminding everybody of the importance of the Good Friday Agreement and that we need to Irish America will remain involved. So Irish America hasn't gone away, but it's sort of looking to some degree from the sidelines. But in this case, it didn't have to do any more because the Irish and British governments managed it on their own.
Would the threat from Nancy Pelosi, the Democrats, and for that matter, the waffle from the current administration, that pretty much said, if you don't adhere to the Good Friday Agreement and all aspects of such, we're not going to knock out a trade deal for Britain and for Northern Ireland, and Brexit is barreling down the road.
Yes.
Would that have had an impact, or is that kind of just for us over here so we get some acknowledgement?
Well, it should have an impact. The parties in Northern Ireland and the Irish and British governments, I mean, the ground is shifting in Northern Ireland. It was shifting anyway internally. There was rot set in, 3 years of a lack of government. There were signs of real sort of degeneration in public services. We had an extraordinary strike by nurses in Northern Ireland recently. That never happens, but, you know, in that vacuum, bad things were happening. And then on top of that, Brexit is only days away. The triggering of Brexit is only days away. The ground is moving under the feet of politicians, not just in Northern Ireland, but in all of Ireland. So there was certainly, there had to have been a said, look, we need to be in place. We need to be at our desks. We need to be ready for what happens. And then, of course, there is the matter of trade. Northern Ireland is going to be profoundly affected, especially in the agricultural sector. And then it's still part of the UK, so it comes into the mix in terms of a future US-UK trade agreement, which, as you mentioned, Speaker Pelosi, Congressman Neal and others have said will simply not take place if there are profound negative effects on the Good Friday Agreement and the peace process. So this is the, sort of the elephant in the room that's getting bigger by the day. And I think that it was certainly, the politicians, the parties in Northern Ireland realized this. And if they were still outside Stormont when this started to happen, I think voters would have revolted. Brexit, trade, all these things are sort of looming large and loom larger still, despite the fact that the politicians have gone back into Stormont. But it's better they're in there than outside.
My guest, Ray O'Hanlon, senior editor of the Irish Echo newspaper and author. We just throw that one in there.
you want to announce it, dude?
I know, it's not my place to...
No, it's not my place
to say that, many of us have been nagging you, say, okay, read the new book, how far are you, what's the chapter are you up to now, and so forth. Yeah. So we don't, but other than that, I have nothing to say about it unless you want to mention.
I'll give you, yes, Adrian, yes, you have the exclusive.
Okay.
Because of nagging by you, yeah. and some others, I have in recent days completed a book. On Irish immigration, and its working title is Unintended Consequences, How America's Door Was Closed to the Irish. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be published in May or June, and it's a complete take on Irish immigration to the United States, but with a particular focus on the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act and the profound effects that has had on Ireland, on Irish America, and Irish immigration in the decades since. And it's something that I've been working on for several years, but I suppose in the last year in particular, with you pushing me, I moved to finish and did so shortly before Christmas. So this book will be published in Ireland this time, unlike my previous books, which were published variously in Colorado and Boston. This one will actually be published in Ireland by Merriam Press. So watch this space. We'll talk about it again.
All right. Now, one of your books, The New Irish American, that raised some eyebrows, but it was very informational in the sense that, somehow... We have talked about, and this will be covered obviously in your new book, the unfair reversal of what was a very liberal immigration policy in 1965. And then we kind of don't even explain what that was about. But on the new Irish American... That is still going strong. What was your focus of, New Irish American?
Well, that was a book that kind of veered across subject matters. Immigration was a very serious part of it, but also politics. The U.S. Sort of move to intervene in Ireland, President Clinton and all that, cultural aspects of Ireland that prevailed during the 80s and 90s in particular, and here in the United States, changes to Irish America. It's sort of a broad brush,
right,
if you will, over a range of different subjects in its chapters. Unintended Consequences, however, takes the immigration issue and it focuses specifically on that, with a few chapters that kind of seem to diverge from the narrative. For one, I'll give you an example, and it was a story I did a number of years ago with a Mayo sort of angle on it. The assassination of President Kennedy and the participation of the Irish Army cadet team at the funeral at Arlington National Cemetery. And I use this as a sort of an illustration of the closeness of the relations between Ireland and the United States, that President Kennedy had so admired the drill team when he was visiting Ireland in June of 1963. Jackie Kennedy wanted them at the gravesite. My brother-in-law's brother, Michael McGrath, who was a cadet at the time, ended up being the first manager ever of Knock Airport. There's your Mayo angle. Mm-hmm. Michael was a cadet, and all of his young comrades were dragged out of bed in the middle of the night and put on a plane with Eamon de Valera and flown to the U.S., and they worried all the way across the Atlantic that they had no passports. They were young guys that had never been out of the country and everything else. And they arrived at Idlewild Airport in New York, as it was at the time, and walked down the steps. And there was the Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, to welcome them. And that is just, to me, sort of just how close are these two countries? Never mind passports. The Secretary of State is there to bring you in. And then you set that against what happened just a couple of years later, the 65 Immigration Act, and its unintended consequence, because the United States didn't, the Congress didn't go out of its way to stop Irish people from coming in. They didn't believe that was going to happen at all. But the actual effect was the door basically slammed shut. So within a couple of years, all changed, and changed utterly. So that's just one example. That's a sort of a diverging chapter from the narrative. But the book focuses in the latter part on three particular organizations that were ad hoc, if you will, meeting the times and the circumstances: the American Irish National Immigration Committee, the Irish Immigration Reform Movement, and the Irish Lobby for Immigration Reform. Other groups come into it as well. And, of course, the Ancient Order of Hibernians were a constant right down through the years. But this book, unlike the New Irish Americans, is particularly focused on immigration.
Ray, can, first of all, at a time when there were nominations and support groups for an Irish senator to be included in the future appointed Irish Senate. You probably have forgotten this already, but you were considered to be the most likely candidate, you know, and there we are. So we have to kind of pull back a little bit and say, oh, Billy Lawless, you're very welcome indeed. And we didn't acknowledge that we were supporting you anyway, and a lot of others here. Billy Lawless, first of all, what is the significance of, in the Irish Senate, to have somebody who is added to the Senate, theoretically to represent the diaspora, but in reality, it has an amazing significance for those of us in the United States, North America in particular.
Yeah, and you're I think it was just as well that I stayed where I was all of those years ago when the idea of an Irish diaspora representative in the Senate sort of came up. Billy Lawless, far better person for that. I think, you know, the appointment of a senator for the diaspora, and Billy Lawless, was an absolutely perfect choice. And as you know, he is the Irish Echo's Irish American of the Year for 2020. The symbolism, the breaking of an old way in Ireland of the emigrant being gone and departed and exiled and vanished and distant, and everybody sort of weeping or trying to forget that they were ever in the family home. And now, I mean, those days have been going, gone for a long time because of modern communications, air travel, the internet, and all the rest of it. But there was a missing ingredient in that, and that was the sort of political connection between Ireland and its diaspora that has been coming more into view. It's more than just symbolic. It is a pulling and a drawing together, and a reminder that we're still, that the Irish community around the world is still an Irish community, each dependent on the other. Irish diplomacy has certainly been directed this way too over the years. The difference, we would have to go back in a time machine 100 years, 150 years to understand the psychology of what it once was. And it was hard, to say the least. It's still hard. It's still hard to leave the land of your birth and move away, but it's not as hard as it was, except, and I should not forget this, unless, of course, you're undocumented in the United States and you cannot return, even for the likes of a wedding or a funeral, because of the bars, the 3 and the 10 year bars. But if you're not sort of ring-fenced by that reality, the changes, the psychological changes are profound. And I think the idea that the diaspora is represented in the Oireachtas in Dublin, I think, is encouraging.
Mm. A thought struck me there, but I wouldn't want to mention it on air, that you know, you being tabbed as, you know, a potential senator representing the diaspora, I'm talking about Ireland, and Neil O'Dowd, who would deny that he was ever running for president. Jesus, that's a bit of... Oh, boy. Okay, we let that one go. But I do want to wrap this up, if you don't mind, on
yes.
telling us now with, you know, the re-establishment of the Assembly in Northern Ireland, will it make a huge difference that, you know, the Assembly now will have to kind of be, let's say, somewhat a lot nicer to, you know, Britain and to and to Ireland and to the Irish government? Will they be, anytime there's a bit of a deadlock in Stormont, can you see, you know, the Irish and British governments coming in and say, hey, this is different. This is not going to, you know, we brokered the deal, you stick to it, or can we expect that same infighting with, you know, with the DUP and Sinn Féin?
Given the nature of, I think you can expect certainly a political disagreement in the assembly, in the executive. But again, I think that the changes that are coming down the road because of Brexit are so potentially profound that some of what we recognize as the normal, old, traditional disagreements in Northern Ireland could really be swept aside by forces that we have hitherto not seen. The actual future of the United Kingdom, never mind the island of Ireland,
yeah.
is in question. So, you know, there are new factors coming in from the sides here that are going to really draw on the attention and energies of the politicians at Stormont. And I think they realize that, to some extent, the old differences are going to matter less and less, because on behalf of those who voted them into the building,
mm-hmm.
They are going to have their work cut out 7 days a week just to keep the whole project on the road. We cannot predict what's going to happen. January 31st, Brexit is triggered. For months, a year afterwards, Boris Johnson is saying, you know, negotiating a trade deal with the European Union, and that, of course, includes the Republic of Ireland. They're going to be at this 24/7, just dealing with this, never mind, you know, where the flag is flying. So I'm not sure if they're going to have time for certain disagreements. And the Irish and British governments at times may not have time for their disagreements. Everybody's got their work cut out.
Ray O'Hanlon, again, thank you for joining us. And on this, it is going to be, and this, you know, this will be considered an historic day for Ireland. And it is, I think we can all be happy that they got this done without waiting for the outcome of Brexit, which seems at best to be messy, as you know, as we lead up to yet a deadline, which this time we can believe is a deadline with respect to Brexit. Right, thank you. And again, that's, by the way, you can take a few days off now, now that you have that book, which we will not mention. And good luck, and again, thank you.
Thank you, Adrian.
All right. Ray O'Hanlon and their friends, live. And again, it is a great day, and I think that you know, when all is said and done, this is an historic day. It is. It's great. The Northern Ireland Assembly, which again collapsed 3 years ago, back up and running. Okay.